Ani, and welcome to Bomsida, an Aboriginal news magazine program that features news, current affairs, a focus on community and culture, spotlights on entertainment and great tunes, and every flavor from Aboriginal artists. I'm your host, Jennifer Ashwasage. Coming up in today's program, a U of BC study that has linked infectious diseases to multi-generational trauma from residential school, a group of Saskatchewan youth are producing their own public service announcement, and Bomsida co-op student Deidre Condon will give you the details on that story. Plus, a paper out from the Frontier Centre on Public Policy is recommending the volunteer relocation of non-viable reserves, and the Grand Chief of the Anishinaabe Asky Nation reacts to the study's recommendations, and Bomsida will begin its monthly special on government relations with policy analyst Mickey Poslins, and we'll hear from filmmaker Neil Diamond on his film Real Engine. The stories plus great tunes all coming your way after the news. Here's your national Aboriginal news. First Nation leaders are worried to hear the worst about education funding as Ottawa ponders its 2010 budget. According to the Globe and Mail, the federal government is reviewing its funding for First Nation post-secondary funding as education is the top priority for Aboriginal leaders across Canada. The government has been spending about $300 million a year on post-secondary funding, which has helped about 22,000 students receive their education. Canada is aiming to reduce its $56 billion deficit, which is what worries First Nation leaders. They're concerned that while the government is reviewing its budget, education funding could be handed to a third party, turned into a loan program, or cut. Ontario Regional Chief Angus Toulouse told the Globe he's expecting the worst. And the federal budget will be tabled next week. Meanwhile, in Alberta, First Nation leaders, the provincial and federal governments are promising to work together to reduce Aboriginal dropout rates. Leaders and government signed an agreement earlier this week. But the Calgary Herald reports there's no new cash attached to the agreement, and it also called for an Indigenous Knowledge and Wisdom Centre to create an education expertise hub for First Nations in the province. Dropout rates for Aboriginal youth off reserve in the province are double than for other students, with graduation rates generally worse on reserve. The Aboriginal Pavilion at the 2010 Winter Games is drawing up to 14,000 visitors per day. Wade Grant is a band counselor at the Musqueam First Nation. He told the province newspaper it's been very successful beyond their hopes and dreams. Grant says they want this to continue and have a future after the games. Meanwhile, the four-host First Nation Pavilion and the BC Hydro Home built out of shipping containers will also have a future after the games. The Musqueam band wants to relocate the $3.5 million building to the heart of their community, which is the center of Vancouver. It would cost about $250,000 to move the building to a new foundation. It was built in modular units, so one of the First Nations could reuse it. All 1,600 Musqueam band members will help decide the building's future use. Meantime, a number of off-reserve groups have told the Vancouver Sun that the game's organizers have left them out in the cold. The group of 25 urban Aboriginal groups have recently formed into a coalition called the Metro Vancouver Aboriginal Executive Council. The council says while it's pleased to see the involvement of the four host First Nations, there's nothing to show for the 60,000 off-reserve people. Christine Smith-Parnell is the council's chair, and she told The Sun, the four host First Nations is doing a wonderful job making sure they're taking care of their communities, but her job is to look after the urban Aboriginal community. She says not one of the 25 groups in Vancouver has seen a penny of the Legacy Fund. Smith Parnell also said letters were written to Vanok to ask for a meeting, but the requests have been ignored. However, four host First Nations CEO Tawani Joseph told The Sun that he doesn't know of any urban Aboriginal consortium. Joseph said he wasn't contacted and he would return calls as well as work together to ensure all Aboriginal people can benefit. Kanulik Cree Nation youth in Saskatchewan are producing a public service announcement to help create more awareness on suicide prevention. More from Bomsida co-op student Deidre Conton.
Youth in Kanulik Cree Nation in Saskatchewan are hoping their PSA will air on major networks. The group is working with a number of people, including actor Dakota House, hypnotist Scott Ward, Chicken Horse Productions, and the Going Miles Society. Dakota House is with Going Miles, and he says a suicide prevention awareness video is from the youth's perspective.
When we're using the ideas that are coming from the youth, we're really getting a bird's eye view of what our children, what our future leaders, what our kids are dealing with.
House says the public service announcement should be complete by the end of this month. He says once done, they'll be sending the PSA out to major broadcasters. For Bombsida, I'm Deidre Conton.
Pasquot First Nation in Hot Springs Cove, BC is hoping for its community to become fossil-free in 3 years. The community will be following the lead of another BC community, Tisuke First Nation, and to rely on renewable energy. It was reported in January that some community members in Hot Springs Cove had gone for weeks without diesel to heat their homes. The community is a 42-kilometer trip by boat from Tofino and is not on the BC hydro grid. Band Councillor Carol Ann Hilton says the community is working with First Power and partnering with PowerTech Labs and Energy Alternatives to achieve the goal of becoming fossil-free. She told Canada.com that the community wants to replace all diesel dependency and start to generate power through a combination of wind and solar sources. The BC All Chiefs Task Force is calling on Canadians to support the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. The task force is also seeking support to push for a national public inquiry into missing and murdered Aboriginal women in this country. Chief Wayne Christensen is the spokesperson for the BC All Chiefs Task Force. He says now is the right time to seek public backing for the campaign.
I think the Olympics is the opportune time because they're talking about sort of nationalism and being patriotic about Canada and the flag. And so what we're saying is that it's good to do, but the reality is Canada, to be a leader in human rights, has to deal with the issue of the UN Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous People.
The task force has prepared an open letter to the Prime Minister requesting Canada to sign on to the declaration. An electronic copy of the letter can be found at the First Nations Task Force website. Meantime, the United Nations is slamming the Australian government over its proposed reforms to the Northern Territory intervention. According to the National Indigenous Times, the Northern Territory intervention is a program that has forced a series of tough rules on Aboriginal people, including bans on alcohol and hardcore pornography, in response to an investigation that found rampant child sexual abuse in remote Indigenous communities. A UN official told the NIT on February 23rd that the Australian government's intervention into Northern Territory Indigenous communities is inherently racist, breaches international human rights obligations, and must be changed immediately. James Anaya, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Indigenous Human Rights, has expressed serious concerns over the controversial initiatives designed to stop child sexual abuse in Aboriginal communities. He says the measures specifically target Indigenous people and impair certain rights and freedoms. Anaya traveled to several communities last summer to hear concerns over the new program. His findings will be released next week. Aboriginal people make up about 2% of the Australian population of about 22 million and are the country's poorest, unhealthiest, and most disadvantaged minority in the country. Real Injun is a film which takes an often humorous but insightful look at Aboriginal people in Hollywood movies. The Cree filmmaker Neil Diamond says the idea for the documentary stemmed from his childhood.
I get all these weird questions from my classmates or people I'd meet in Ottawa and Hull South, you know, asking if we lived in teepees, rode horses, or they'd ask if, you know, why is your hair curly? You know, why isn't it long and straight like all Indians? So I started wondering where these ideas came from, and I figured it, the only place people were seeing natives at the time was like in movies, westerns, on TV.
Diamond got further inspiration when he watched a movie with white actors starring as Aboriginal people.
I was watching a DVD I'd rented, and it I can't remember the actor, but it was a white actor playing a native guy. I just found it so funny. And I remembered all, like, Elvis Presley, Charles Bronson, Chuck Connors, Raquel Welch, playing Native people.
The movie, Diamond says, is part road trip. The film is playing at several theaters and urban centers throughout Canada, including Toronto and Vancouver, and it's also on tour with Imaginative. And that's your National Aboriginal News.
Feel you when I close my eyes. fingertips, they touch my sky. Pull me down from the tree. I'm up here for you, daddy. 'Cause when you call out my name,
Meister with Now from her CD Just the Beginning. Megan is a trip-hop and R&B singer-songwriter with Irish, Cree, and Dene roots, and she hails from Winnipeg. A University of British Columbia study, the CEDAR Project, has linked hepatitis C virus and HIV to multi-generational trauma from residential school. The study involved more than 500 Aboriginal youth on the streets of Vancouver in Prince George. Celestine Chief Wayne Christensen is the spokesperson for the CEDAR Project.
Well, the CEDAR Project is a study that is tracking youth on the street. And it's really looking at the issues of HIV and sort of the impacts that, as an example, residential school has on that. The issues related to multi-generational trauma in terms of youth that are being impacted on the streets right now and its correlation to HIV or infectious disease. The most recent finding is that there's a connection between HCV, which is hepatitis C, and the issue of multi-generational trauma in the residential school. A study that is really quite impactful because it gives us a really good idea of what's going on and why our people are on the streets.
What were some of the most significant findings to you?
I think the most significant findings is the relationship of residential school to the youth, because a lot of these young people don't even know what residential school is. And I think for them to understand that there's a connection in terms of this historical, you know, the official government, the policy was to kill the Indian and the child through the residential schools. And even though the residential schools closed in the 1980s, still it's having an impact on the young people today because of the multi-generational impact that happened to their parents and their grandparents.
What were some of the other findings?
I think the issue is the vulnerability as an example of young women on the streets and the relationship that has to HCV infection and the violence in terms of the issues of sexual abuse that are the issue of addictions, again, because of the nature of the study is looking at IV drug users and those kinds of issues.
So where are you going to go with these findings now?
Well, I think, Canada made an official apology, I think, in June of 2008, to the survivors of the residential schools. And what we've been trying to advocate is that it's fine to look at that. We've got to deal with the children of those survivors, the next generation. And we're really trying to find a way to use the data in terms of before the Truth and Reconciliation Commission to make a case for resources for the young people, especially those young people that are impacted the most and on the streets of the cities across Canada.
And how important has the study been to the communities?
Well, I think to the communities because it's a partnership with a number of different organizations, Healing Our Spirit, HIV AIDS organizations, as well as Positive Living North and Prince George. What it's doing is giving us the ability to have control over the data and ensure that we can use this to actually do something for the kids. Because the bottom line is that the data is good, but we need to take it into public policy and create resources for the youth on the streets.
And is there not many resources right now for them?
Well, it's very limited right now. I think in British Columbia, as an example, the provincial government is cutting $10 million from their budget for services to youth and families. And if you think about that, the Olympics, the opening ceremonies cost $70 million. So what are their priorities? The priorities aren't for our people, especially the young people that are on the streets, because I think in society today, they're kind of thrown away, and nobody really cares and gives them a voice at all.
Hmm.
Well, I think the most critical part, it is about the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People. If Canada was really sincere about its apologies to our people, they would sign on to that because that document, it gives the minimum standards in terms of basic human rights of our people. And 144 countries have signed it. Canada has not.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, they voted twice against it. So I think that if they're really sincere about the apology to our people, and the Prime Minister, he said he was, but his actions don't speak... His actions don't speak through his words. So.
That was Celestine Chief Wayne Christensen, who also sits on the CEDAR Project Committee, a study which has linked hepatitis C and HIV to multi-generational trauma from residential school. Youth in the Canoe Lake Cree Nation in Saskatchewan are working on an important public service announcement on suicide awareness. Bombsida Co-op student Deidre Conton has more.
Youth in the Canoe Lake Cree Nation are working with a number of Aboriginal role models to produce a suicide awareness public service announcement. The youth are collaborating with the likes of hypnotist Scott Ward and Chicken Horse Productions, as well as company Going Miles. The PSA sprung from a community project last fall with Going Miles, which required the youth to improve their grades in school. The youth have reached that goal to improve their marks and have begun producing the PSA, which is created and written by them. Going Miles spokesperson and actor Dakota House is working with the youth in the Saskatchewan community.
We went out to Canoe Lake to do a workshop. It was a one-day workshop, and from that one-day workshop, we saw that there was a need and an opportunity to present a program to the school. And this program is an academic excellence challenge, and what we're geared towards is bringing up the reading level, mathematics, and attendance all one level. By doing this, some of the incentives are coming into the community and working with writers, directors, producers, actors, storyboard, just the whole production side of filming, and working with them and coming up with a PSA, public service announcement, using the ideas that's coming from here. Now the idea and the issue that we've taken on is the issue on suicide. The one thing that we've seen right across the country is when we've lost too many, and there seems to be an epidemic that's been sweeping the nation for many, many years, and it's time that, there's a program or there's something that's being done that are giving these youth an outlet. And a lot of times, using the medium of film and television, and doing our own stories sometimes is the best, because a lot of times our youth are having a hard time being able to come up with the dialogue in regards to suicide. So by putting this message out there, I think what it's really doing is, I mean, it's really touching people on a number of levels. I mean, suicide, of course, affects us directly and indirectly, but when we're using the ideas that are coming from the youth, we're really getting a bird's eye view of what our children, what our future leaders, what our kids are dealing with.
When will the public service announcement be complete, and where can we see or hear it?
Well, the public service announcement will be complete on the 28th. We have another week before we go down and start shooting the PSA, and then from there we're going to submit it to a number of broadcasters and get it out on the on the wavelength. Hopefully, our biggest goal is that we have youth across the country who are going to be able to tune into today, and it's really going to have a profound effect on them.
That was Dakota House, spokesperson for Going Miles, on the Youth Suicide Awareness Prevention Public Service Announcement being produced by youth on the Canoe Lake Cree Nation. For Bombsida, I'm Deidre Conton.
They say that love is something you cannot feed in an instant, but we know that it's real, 'cause God sent
Bone with Pity the Fool from her CD, No Lies. The Frontier Center for Public Policy recently released a study by policy analyst Joseph Quinnell. The study proposes that First Nations leaders should consider relocating reserves that they don't think are viable. That study elicited the response of at least one leader, Anishinaabe Aski Nation Grand Chief Stan Beardy, one of Nan's communities, Keshechewan First Nation, was mentioned in the study as an example of a non-viable reserve. Joseph Quinnell says the voluntary relocation of what he calls non-viable reserves to urban centers or near-urban centers would significantly help youth and create sustainable economies.
Well, what this study is supposed to do is to try to help create a conversation among First Nations on some of the most isolated reserves, and to discuss kind of their economic options, and to decide whether or not a relocation to an area closer to an urban center might be something that would be worthwhile. Where it started from mainly was, I'm originally from Northern Ontario. I'm from near Sudbury, and when the whole Kaseshuan First Nation issue came to media attention, I was working in an Aboriginal newspaper at the time in Winnipeg and covered that. And I remember, it started a lot of controversy because the federal representative who presented the report looking at Kaseshuan, which was located on a floodplain and which was also very isolated from the commercial market, he had recommended, his name was Alan Pope, he had recommended that First Nation move to within the outskirts of the city of Timmins. Originally, members seemed to support that option, but eventually, for some reason, stay put, and they built on the infrastructure back to the community and basically renewed the First Nation on the same site, which to me basically was saying that we're going to allow the same problems to occur. But what was different about Alan Pope's report is that he actually identified location and isolation as part of the problem with a lot of the First Nations that were located in isolated areas. So we define non-viable reserve as a First Nation community or any community that costs due to location. It has high transportation costs. It's not able to produce a good that or service that can be brought to the market at a reasonable cost because of location. And what I want to stress that from the beginning, we wanted to make this a voluntary initiative on the part of Indigenous leaders in Ottawa. It's not a forced location. That's not what we're talking about at all. I think that those kind of policies are wrong-headed, and we've seen negative consequences happen to them. I think having a voluntary relocation policy by Indigenous people themselves would go a long way towards making the right move for the community. And it would also involve the community actually supporting it. Like it would actually have the consensus. They would have the right location.
One of the issues Stan Beardy, Grand Chief of the Anishinaabe-Yaski Nation, points out is the First Nations had no choice where the reserves were located to begin with and have been marginalized right since the beginning.
First of all, with Anishinaabe-Yaski, we have 49 First Nations, and Kaseshuan is one of them, but I cannot, I'm not speaking just for Kaseshuan, but I'm just making comments in general. First of all, I guess the fact that needs to be realized here is that when treaties were signed, Treaty Number 9, especially Treaty Number 9, the commissioners sat down with us and identified where those reserves should be located. But what needs to be understood and what we understand from historical research is that prior to making treaty with us, by treaty making, the government of Ontario and Canada had already negotiated where those reserves would be located, and they agreed that it has to be away from any potential for economic development. So they made sure that the reserves were located as far away as from any possibility for hydro development, as far away as from good agricultural lands, far away from any mineral potential, because the word reserve in my language is Shkwinigan, meaning leftover waste land.
But Quinnell says not all remote reserves are non-viable because there are many First Nation communities with good economic opportunities through many different industries. He stresses leaders of communities with not a lot of options should talk about relocating to or near urban centers and strike up service agreements with the local municipalities.
What we want to do is a First Nation, if it's not able to come up with economic development, viable economic development plans, given its circumstances, if it's run out of those options and the isolation, the added cost of doing business are so much that they should consider either establishing a new reserve on close to an urban center so they can take advantage of economic and educational opportunities. Now, where the other source of information coming for this idea was, we've had urban reserves and rural reserves for a while now. A fellow by the name of Joseph Garcia, he's a political scientist at the University of Saskatchewan, did a comprehensive look at urban reserves and rural reserves in Saskatchewan. And what he discovered is that there are about 30 First Nations that have established what he called satellite reserves. So through the treaty land entitlement process, where, like in the treaties, the First Nations were guaranteed a certain amount of acres based on family size. And we've discovered for a while now that formula, there were problems with that. So First Nations are entitled to extra land. And so over the last while, First Nations in the Prairie Provinces, subject to treaties, have been able to purchase land. a lot of this land is very good land. Just the problem right now is that the land that they purchased, which is very close to urban centers, sometimes inside, right, with urban reserves, is that they're mainly used for commercial, agricultural, or institutional uses. So, like, they'll build a business there. But a lot of the land, it can actually be, you can develop residential subdivisions on it. They've been able to purchase this land. The only barrier to that is just no one's really, no one's taken that step of saying, you know what, we have these extra lands, we can convert it into reserve status. We can make agreements with nearby municipalities to harmonize our bylaws, to also develop a service agreement so that the municipality can perhaps provide services to a First Nation that relocates closer to an urban center, and they could live, they could have a viable community, and they could be, they could still live as a community, yet still access the economic and educational opportunities by living by an urban center could afford.
But before considering relocating a reserve, Beardy says during treaty making, First Nations didn't even consider reserves at that time, and because of the treaty, Beardy says there should be more resource revenue sharing.
I think we need to look at the historical fact. The historical fact is that we never agreed to reserve systems. We agreed to peaceful coexistence in our case, in our territory. We're talking about a land base 2/3 of Ontario, and that's our land. We're not talking about a reserve. We're talking that's our homeland. That's where we have lived for thousands of years. That's where we are today, and that's where we will be in the next thousands of years. But the point here is that there's billions of dollars taken out of our lands, and that's what we need to look at, is to make sure that the wealth is shared with us as per treaty making.
But as far as revenue sharing goes, Quinnell says that may not be enough to create employment.
We've seen already that First Nation leaders no longer just view the First Nation territory as just the reserve land that they were given in a treaty, and it was really created by the federal government. Like, you have urban reserves, you have rural reserves, that so people they're looking at the land base as just not that, just the specific reserve. And what we would say, is that a First Nation, if they're able to come up with revenue sharing agreements or other royalties or any type of regime like that, if that is able to support the community, then they believe that would create sustainable employment, then I would say go for that. I just, like, relying on some of these royalties and relying on some of these revenue sharing, it's not, from what I've seen, and if a lot of First Nations, you're looking at federal transfers representing 80 to 100% of the revenue, adding in whatever percentage from resource revenues, although it would be good, obviously, it wouldn't be able to create the sustainable jobs that the community needs. And what we're saying is that a lot of the dysfunction and the problems that we're seeing is because of a lack of opportunity, economic opportunity. There are other reasons, obviously, the effects of the residential school experience. We're not discounting that, and we're discounting other, just the destabilizing, effects of the whole reserve system. It's the lack of opportunity, which, people, they've lost their kind of sense of the breadwinner, and just having a hope for the future. We feel that's creating a lot of the problems. And if a community stays and it's just reliant on resource royalties or some of the others, those are good sources. But I don't think that that's enough. A First Nation could relocate its community to an urban reserve. It's the residential part of it, and yet still they would still always retain Aboriginal title to that land. They would still be collecting royalties. So in that sense, it'd be win-win. They did that. But what we wanted to stay away from is saying that this is a decision that Indigenous communities need to decide for themselves. Like, they have to decide, are we viable, are we non-viable? And I just think that, if they're honest with themselves, they'll look at what they have, the prospects, and say, maybe for the sake of the younger generation, a move as a community, it's not like everyone's necessarily, you're going to have the community all divided up, but the community moves together, based on their own goals, they're the ones deciding, then perhaps that could be a good move.
Quinnell admits relocating reserves is not a cure-all, but after looking at data from Statistics Canada, Aboriginal people living in urban centres have higher education and higher-paying jobs. And he adds, over time, communities could adjust to living in urban centres. Starting this month, I'm going to be speaking with policy analyst Mickey Poslins about parliamentary relations and legislation affecting First Nations. Poslins is also the author of George Manuel's biography, who is the second chief of the National Indian Brotherhood, which is now the Assembly of First Nations. And Poslins has also been keeping his eye on parliamentary committees on Aboriginal matters for about four decades. Poslins will give us an overview and tell us why it's important to keep track of government committees.
Any bill that has received the second of three readings that every bill gets in both houses or each house, the bill goes to committee, and the minister and his officials testify, but very often there'll be people with interest. So that the Assembly of First Nations, for instance, has periodically had a whole special program for parliamentary liaison, and I started that program working for Noel Starblanker when he was president of the National Indian Brotherhood, and I'm told that the national chief today, Sean Atleo, has just started the program. And the purpose of that would be to educate the member, well, any interested member of parliament or senator, but the ones on the committees have a specific responsibility to inform themselves and become better educated on Aboriginal issues.
And why is that important to for people to know, Mickey?
Well, because they're the ones that are going to recommend policy in their general studies and going to pass or amend legislation when bills come down. So the last time there was a whole slew of bills on Aboriginal issues was when Bob Nault was Minister of Indian Affairs and brought in what was then called a suite of bills on First Nations governance, on taxation, I believe on education, and on one other thing. I know there were four bills. And all of the First Nations organizations across the country were strongly opposed to these bills. And you then want to influence the people who have to vote in favor of the bills to get them passed. And in fact, three of the four of them were stopped. The Commons Committee went across the country holding hearings, and so the people did not have to travel to Ottawa. But I think is the most interesting thing that the committees have done is to hold general studies it's quite some time ago, but in 1983, the Commons Committee on Indian Affairs, as it was called then, did a study for a year on different views of self-government and wrote a report that is still, I think, a model of its kind, setting out how self-government could be implemented that would be a genuine self-government and get Indian Affairs out of managing Indian Affairs. And in the last several years, Senator Jerry C. Germain, chairman of the Senate committee, has been sponsoring a bill that would implement that. And the Senate committee has then held hearings on it. So the three kinds of things they do are study of bills that are sent to them, particularly government bills, and study of general topic and sometimes large questions like government. And more recently, they've been holding hearings up until the House was prorogued on rather specific subject. The specific one that caught my attention from last fall, early winter, was the honor of the crown, which is basically a term that the Supreme Court has coined in interpreting what the government's obligations are under the section of the Constitution Act 1982 that recognizes and affirms Aboriginal and treaty rights. So this is another way in which the members are trying to inform themselves. As far as they got was to hear from the lawyer from the Department of Justice by the Department of Indian Affairs and an assistant deputy minister. And the following week, they heard from a man who had represented the Ontario government for 25 years. There had been talk in the committee about hearing from various First Nations and Aboriginal organizations. That would have been happening now had Parliament not been prorogued.
That was Mickey Poslins, a policy analyst. He will be a guest on Bombsidel once a month to report on government committees as they relate to Aboriginal matters. And I apologize for the sound quality of that interview. Now here's Honey Why from Métis artist Roland Majot from his CD, Bugs in a Jar.
You need to be free. For when times are against you on this way through life, it's worth knowing the Lord more each day. You'll make the world a difference in a different way, in a world that often is cruel. You'll make the sun shine brighter on a cloudy day just to show his love to you. If it sounds like I'm trying to make you be a person the Lord can use, that's exactly what I'm trying to tell myself, that to be used, you've got to be true. can make the world a difference in a different way in a world that often is cruel. You'll make the sun shine brighter on a cloudy day just to show his love to you. Make world of difference in a different way in a world that often is cruel. He'll make the sun shine brighter on a cloudy day just to show his love to you. If you're gonna serve somebody in this old world, you better know what you need to be free. For when times are against you on this way through life, it's worth knowing the Lord more each day. He'll make the world a difference in a different way in a world that often is cruel. He'll make the sun shine brighter on a cloudy day just to show his love to you. He'll make the world a difference in a different way in a world that often is cruel. He'll make the sun shine brighter on a cloudy day just to show his love to you.
Where's Wendy Bill?
That little fella right over there.
I'd like to challenge Wendy Bill.
You bring it on, cowboy!
Says, I want a real night up front. I want to see the real thing. We couldn't find one.
White people playing native roles. I love it because it's funny.
Probably thought that Indians never had a sense of humor, you know? We never thought you were too funny either.
There's always this kind of John Wayne guy that is sort of the moral standard that represents America.
Break out the grain.
Dances with Wolves.
It was a box office hit. It picked up several Oscars, including Best Picture.
It's a story about a white guy. And Indians are the TNA.
I had to learn Lakota.
Okay, of course, you Wanjish.
I can't even speak my own language. The only language I speak is English, not very well.
That's the trailer for Real Engine, a documentary by Cree filmmaker Neil Diamond. The film takes a look at Hollywood stereotypes of Indians in the movies and television. Neil Diamond spoke with Bamsida.
Well, a lot of the stereotypes that have been in Hollywood movies about Native people are still exist today. You know, the spiritual Native guy, Indian princess, even the savage still comes up every once in a while. And the wise elder. Yeah, like the movies that were released like 2 years ago still have those stereotypes.
Including the newest blockbuster, Avatar.
Avatar. You mean Dance This with Pocahontas in Space?
Yeah.
Yeah, those are great film, you know, but the story is one that's been told before in depth with Pocahontas.
Mm-hmm.
But it just looks beautiful, you know, in 3D and IMAX.
Mm-hmm.
I had a great time seeing it.
So why did you decide to do Real Engine?
Well, first of all, for survival, because I need work and money. But going to school in the South, I get all these weird questions from classmates or people I'd meet in Ottawa and Hull, so, you know, asking if we lived in teepees and rode horses, or they'd ask if, why is your hair curly, and, why isn't it long and straight like all Indians? So I started wondering where these ideas came from, and I figured the only place people were seeing natives at the time was like in movies, westerns, on TV, and in magazines too. You know, every time you saw Native people, they were wearing their buckskin, you know, the powwow or something, braided hair, feathers. I figured that this is where all these ideas came from. And a couple of years later, fast forward, I had a couple years ago, maybe 7-8 years ago now. I was watching a DVD I'd rented. I can't remember the actor, but it was a white actor playing a native guy. I just found it so funny. And I remembered all, like, Elvis Presley, Charles Bronson, Chuck Connors, Raquel Welch, playing native people. I thought I'd pitch an idea to APTF, do a funny half-hour doc. I was going to call it I'm Not Indian, But I Play One on TV. I thought it was a great title. So yeah, that's pretty much why. You know,
so how damaging do you think those stereotypes are?
Being portrayed as a savage and the buffoon doesn't help with young native kids' self-esteem. Younger people start to believe in those portrayals that they see. You know, even the so-called good stereotypes, you know, they really start to believe that too. And they actually a lot of people take advantage of that. The outside world too, like native people, they take advantage of those perceptions that people have of them. I have not a friend, he's an acquaintance. Like, he totally uses that to meet women. And they totally buy into it, you know. Like, they love the hair, they love the mystique, the noble red man.
Yeah, it's not funny, but I know some of those who.
Yeah, I know. I've never been tempted, you know, but.
So I was watching the trailers for Real Engine, and I noticed a clip on there with Clint Eastwood saying that. They were supposed to be looking for a real Indian, and he couldn't find one. And I thought that was quite absurd, considering how many reservations are around even California.
Yeah. Well, this was probably in the late 50s when he started acting in on TV. He was on TV as Rowdy Yates in a TV series called Rawhide, I believe it was, or something like that. And, there were a lot of native actors around, but they weren't being hired. They were hiring Italians and Jews and, even though there were a lot of actors around at the time. Because during the silent era, there were a lot of native filmmakers. Two of the biggest directors, producers, writers, and stars in their own films were... a guy called Edwin Carew and James Youngdear, and they were huge, you know. And the power couple, the quote-unquote power couple, then Brad and Angelina of the day, were James Youngdear and Mona Darkfeather, and they were making hit films. And then that all changed when sound came in. Then you got people like Chief Buffalo Chow Longlance and Iron Eyes Hody, who were the famous Indians. So the actors were there, but they weren't being hired, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There were a few who got jobs, but mostly guys in wigs and
standing in the background.
Yeah.
So the other thing I noticed from the trailers, because I haven't been able to watch the film just yet, is that you've applied a lot of humor instead of being angry about all the stereotypes that Hollywood depicts.
Yeah. Well. You know, if you do it with anger, it just turns people off, you know? Like, I remember being in school and having teachers, like, get angry when they're trying to teach you, and you just close yourself off, you know? But if they did it in an entertaining way, you know, like, you listened and you enjoyed it and you learned something, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, well, there's been many documentaries that I've seen that are... You know, that have no humor in them. They're very serious, and nobody really enjoyed them. You know, you just walk out of the theater feeling bad and depressed. You just want to go out and drink or something.
So, on the
if I could just continue on the on the idea of humor. That's one thing I remember. Just going through the films that I'd seen when I was a kid and just doing research. I don't remember a time I saw a Native person in movies smiling, you know, or joking until Chief Dan George, you know, being funny in Little Big Man. You know, that was the only time anybody saw an Indian smile. And then just, you know, the great sense of humor. You know, they'll laugh at anything. And they'll tease each other. And that's just a way of showing, you know, respect and that you like the person.
Sometimes we just don't want to be on the receiving end. But it seems that that your film also, from watching all the trailers, is that you're kind of poking fun at Hollywood at the same time and using that teasing sense of humor that we have.
Yeah. Well, I love Hollywood movies, you know. And, teasing it out of real affection.
That was Cree filmmaker Neil Diamond on his film Real Injun. The film is playing at several theaters in urban centers, including Toronto and Vancouver, and is also now on tour with Imaginative. You've been listening to Bomb Sit Out with Jennifer Ashwasige. Bomb Sit Out is an Aboriginal news magazine program which includes current affairs, arts and entertainment, and a cross genre of music from Aboriginal artists. Bomb Sit Out means walking together in the Anishinaabe language. Music for the program is courtesy of Burnt Project One.